Welcome to the IRIS podcast. You're listening to a talk as part of the Designing Longitudinal Research in Complex Multiprofessional Environments conference, organised by the Scottish Child Care and Protection Network. This talk was recorded on the 20th of April 2011. Stephanie Lalonde, NLSCY Canada, Key Issues for Longitudinal Research, A View from Overseas, the National Longitudinal Study of Children and Youth, NLSCY.
So today I'm going to talk about an overview of the NLSCY, a bit of its history, some of the design decisions that we've made, go through the content and the direct assessments that we have as part of the survey, and talk about some of the specific parts like the school collection, a little touch a bit on the research, and some of the lessons learned we did from the survey. So the NLSCY is a long-term study of Canadian children that follows the development from birth to early childhood. And it's conducted by Statistics Canada, and it's funded by Human Resources and Skills Development Canada, HRSDC. Now, StatsCan is the National Statistical Agency of Canada, and our mandate is to collect, compile, analyze, and publish statistical information. So sort of similar to the ONS, but not exactly the same. The survey funder is the policy department, and they have a very broad mandate that I've paraphrased and to say to support Canadians in making choices that help them live productive and rewarding lives and improve Canadians' quality of life. So pretty much anything can fit into that mandate. And that's been one of our challenges, too. And someone asked what the question is. Well, that's the question. How do we answer that question? So StatsCan manages the project. We collect the data. We process the data. We disseminate the data. HRC gives us the money, which is very nice, and they are in charge of funding the research program, and that department has had very many changes over the years. I think they've had four names in the time I've worked with them, so how much effort they put into research program has changed over time as well. So the survey started development in 92, and our last data release was in the fall of 2010. That's actually our last data release. The survey is completed. That decision was a long time coming, and there was lots of back and forth about it. I haven't quite adjusted to the fact yet myself, so my tenses will probably be off. Sometimes I'll talk in the past, sometimes the present, because I'm not quite there yet that we're done. We are still surveying children. We just started a new cross-sectional survey of children that does have a lot of the same content, but we're not following this cohort anymore. So those are the objectives. They're quite broad. They're supposed to be, so if you look at them, they're a mix of cross-sectional and longitudinal objectives. So we want some prevalence information and also understand how these factors affect children over time. Some of these objectives have been better realized than others in the survey. I'll talk about it a bit more. Really wanted to cover a wide variety of information about children. And when NLSCY started, there was really the only national data available on children in Canada. So a bit of history. We started the plan. I wasn't there. But the planning for the survey started in May of 93. And they got the first data collection out in the fall of 94. And I'd love to have seen how they did that, because the planning report was very high-level planning. And then they had it ready to go in the field in just a year and a half. We collected data every 2 years, starting in 94, the last one ending in the spring of 2009. So where the idea came from was a Canadian government initiative called Brighter Futures. And the aim of Brighter Futures was to reduce the risk to children through prevention, promotion of the value of children and parents in society, protection, strengthen measures to protect children from threats to their well-being, and partnership, so to enable community members to address the health and developmental needs of children in high-risk communities, particularly in the Aboriginal population. Now, the NLSCY itself did not cover the community portion or the Aboriginal portion, but there were some side projects I'll talk about a little bit, too, that covered that. And you see the mandate was to develop both the longitudinal and cross-sectional data on children. So, of course, that affected the design considerably. So the implications on design for the origins were that we need to provide longitudinal and cross-sectional information, that we wanted to have a holistic approach to look at risk and outcomes, that we wanted to provide information on children and their families, and to have community information, and to conduct information from teachers as well. to get information from, not just from parents, but also from teachers. So this meant that we had a very complicated design so we can cover both longitudinal and cross-sectional. It also did give us some efficiencies in terms of sample size. If you're doing two separate groups, there was the sample size was smaller than that. But it does complicate the use of the file, weighting the file, the processing of the data, some of the issues that Paul talked about earlier. And because we wanted to have a very holistic approach, we had a general population survey. We didn't target any particular groups. We did have a slight oversample of the youngest children, but that was the only targeting we did. And we wanted to make sure that we had, of course, good cooperation and looking at respondent burden attrition. And because of the information we're looking for, it was going to be a very long interview. The first wave of data collection, we took up to 4 children in the household, so I'm sure the interviewer must have moved in for the day to get everything. That only lasted once. We cut that back after the first wave. So we had to do face-to-face interviews, which StatCan does telephone interviews, but we did also face-to-face interviews in the beginning to make sure we got that cooperation, and, of course, that leads to there's cost issues with that. And the teacher information is quite a logistical challenge, and I will go into detail about that later. So this is our design, our overview of the cohorts that we have. So the blue arrows, the long blue arrows, are the original cohort that we had from the beginning. So at cycle one, that's what the one data are all the cycles, we had children from 0 to 11 years old. We followed them all the way through 8 cycles, every 2 years, so in cycle two, they're 2 to 13, and so on until our last cycle, they were 14 to 25. Early on, we decided we wanted to keep the full age range, so we went back and added 0 to 1-year-olds, so we'd have, so you see cycle two, still the full age is covered. And we decided to follow those children until they were 5. So they were followed for 3 cycles. So you can see the colors here show the same children being followed over time. For cycle 7, our client decided they'd like to know more about, we have all this information about the early child development. We do quite a few assessments at 4 and 5-year-olds, see if they're ready for school, but then we don't find anything about when they go to school. So we thought, well, we followed them for a few more years. So that's why those extra two are added in cycle 7, the 6 to 9-year-olds. And cycle 8 is actually those 8 to 11-year-olds are a mistake. I don't know how that got in the slide. We didn't actually cover it. We only went to age 7 in cycle 8. Some of these decisions are based on decisions made by the policy department, and I like the quote that Paul had in his presentation about, you know, well-planned and one principal investigator, and we broke all those rules. And the main reason that we went with the 0 to 11 in the beginning is because we wanted that cross-sectional data and we wanted to put out data right away after the first cycle. So that gave you that cross-sectional perspective in the early years of the survey. Because people are impatient for data, and that was one of the ways to make sure that they got it. So these are sample sizes and the number of respondents and the at-collection response rate you can see on the side. And that's just for the original cohort, so the big blue arrows, not all the smaller cohorts. If you look closely at the numbers, you'll see there's some inconsistencies in the original sample sizes because of some decisions that we made over time that changed definitions. So don't look too closely. Just round those numbers a little bit. And the first wave doesn't include the child 3 and 4 in the families that we didn't continue to follow. We kind of went revisionist history and only count the ones that we followed over time. So those ones that we dropped are only really available for cross-sectional analysis in the first wave. So we started with just under 17,000 children in the first wave, and those are response rates over time. And as you can see, they are kind of coming down quite quickly. And that's mainly because of the response rates of the older. Once they get past about 16, they're getting much harder to contact. And so that's where it's bringing those numbers down quite a bit. And like Gus, we do send people back to the field if they didn't respond in the previous cycle. So not everybody has a full cycle of data, all 8 cycles. It's about 44% that have, or 7,500 respondents that we have the full range of data for. So this is to give you a flavor of that's sort of the longitudinal aspect. This is sort of a snapshot of one cycle with all the different aspects. That's the whole ages, so the 0 to 7-year-olds, and then the 14 to 25-year-olds, the longitudinal cohort, and the numbers. So if you see, the response rates are quite different depending on the age groups. And see, the older ones are quite low. And that was what brings the total down. And also, the other thing to notice here is that the ECD, the early years cohorts, are actually more than half of the sample. So it really does divide up our focus between the more cross-sectional or the small longitudinals and the original cohort. So as I said, we went out every 2 years. And, of course, the choice of 2 years was the compromise between getting information regularly and the response burden and the cost. We had discussed potentially going out more often with the younger children and then going out less often with the older ones. If we'd followed them past 25, we were thinking maybe skipping them every second so they go every 4 years, but since we didn't continue, that didn't happen. We used mixed modes. We started off always in person the first couple of waves, but then after that we do both telephone and in the home, and mostly based on interviewer workload and the household preference. We always try over the phone, but we'll go to the house if that's what they want. But there are some things, that we do need to do in the home. We do some assessments. The older children create complete paper questionnaires, so those are done in the home. So we get data about the household, the parent, and the child, and we also get some from teachers in some cases, and direct assessments. And as I said earlier, we did some community surveys that I'll go through later. So this is the research framework that the survey sponsor came up with. So the outcomes at the end are, I'm sure, familiar to most people. They're looking at physical health, emotional well-being, language, communication, cognitive, and social. Looking at the resources at the top, the family, community, school, work as the children age, and programs they may be using. A lot of measurement of transitions. And, of course, in the bottom, they're showing time. We're following them over time. So before I talk about the details of the content, I want to just talk about this concept, person the most knowledgeable. We don't necessarily just talk to the child's mother. We have this concept, person the most knowledgeable. How the interview normally works, we normally have the mother's name. So we will ask to speak to the mother. But if the mother's not available and it's the father who answers, we'll talk to him. And so we have a question that says, who is the person most knowledgeable about this child? And that's who we ask to speak to. So the numbers there show how often that is the biological mother versus the father. So most of the time it is the biological mother. Of course, that changes as the children get older. I think the fathers are more comfortable when they get older answering the questions. And the numbers don't add up to 100%. There's a few, like there's some foster parents, grandparents, if it's a teen mom is not uncommon, but those are a very small proportion of the cases. So, of course, having a PMK as opposed to always speaking to the same person, you do get some issues where you have different people reporting at different cycles. So the questionnaires we have a PMK questionnaire, which will cover information about the household, about the adult, and the child themselves. And we have questions about the spouse, which can be answered either by the PMK or the PMK spouse. The child will complete once they are age 10, a paper questionnaire. And starting at 16, we get the information in the computerized questionnaire from the child as well, or the youth. We do direct assessments with the children and youth. And then for the first 5 cycles, we had teacher and principal questionnaires. So that is an overview of the interview for one particular cycle. Every cycle, things were a little bit different, but just to give a quick view of what that looks like. So it starts off, we send an introductory package as well, and one of the things we've tried to do in our introductory package is to make it a little bit enticing and make people want to do it. And we have some restrictions of being a government agency. We don't do these fancy things. We have to put nice, boring brown envelopes as Statistics Canada. Our rules don't allow us to identify the survey on the outside because that could identify that you're in a survey. Oh, your neighbors might find out you have children. So we're not allowed to do that. So a nice boring brown envelope. So we want to encourage people to open it. So one year we actually made it like we put a key chain on it, so it's a bumpy thing. We thought that might make them more likely to open it. We didn't do an evaluation of that, but we were hoping it worked to make them actually open the package. So we do send, and we always put information about the survey findings. We put little things like a growth chart. We don't do pens or magnets because that could identify them, but things that they could keep. We also did one, a couple of years ago, we did a CD with some children's songs on it, which was well received by respondents. So the beginning of the questionnaire is some household information, who's in the house, relationships to each other, confirming addresses. Then we do for the younger children, we get information from the parents about the child. Then we get information from the parents about themselves and their spouses. If you're over 16, you get a questions directly to you. And if you're 10 and over, you'll get a questionnaire that's done on paper with information that, you know, you don't want your parents to hear. And then there are some assessments for 4 and 5-year-olds and school-aged children. So these are some of the subjects we've covered in the adult component. So we find information about the parents' education, labor force, income, health. And then we asked a few questions about their neighborhood and how their family functions. The things like education, labor force, you get from both, and the things that are income is household, family functions, household, neighborhood is household, so usually the PMK reports on those. You have quite a long questionnaire on the children. Not every, there's different questions based on the child's age, so not every child will get all of these questions, but most of them. So for children aged 0 to 15, they'll get most of these. When the child's 16, 17, they get only a few of those. We only ask about a few of those. We get more information from the child or the youth as they get older. And this is what we get from the youth, the 16 and up. So a lot of the some of the same information and some new things. And once they're over 16, the questionnaire is very much geared to age. At the earlier years, if you're 5, you get all these questions. As they get older, we can't use age as much because people are going through things at different stages. You could be 16, you could be in school or not in school. You could be working or not working. So the flow of the questionnaire is more on where your status as opposed to your age as they get older. And the teens get some of these questions on a paper questionnaire that they can take into their room, complete on their own, put in an envelope. Nobody sees it until it comes back to the head office. So, of course, you know, you're not going to answer questions about smoking and drinking in front of your parents, so generally. So those are done that way. And we're very 20th century. Everything's on paper for the self-completes. We don't have any electronic collection for those. So when I spoke to Janice, she said, you're very interested in direct assessment, so I have quite a few slides on those. So hopefully that's still something that people are interested in. Mm-hmm. And it's actually one of my first assignments on the survey was choosing some direct assessment, so it was a little bit of a memory lane time for me to prepare this, so that was nice too. So for the older, we've most of our direct assessments at 4 and 5, and I'll talk about those in detail. I'll just cover these ones quickly. For children in the school-age years, we have a math test that just is basic academic skills, covering things they should have learned at the particular school year. And it's a math assessment that's generally used in Canadian schools. It's a modified version of it. When they're 16 and 17, it's still a math assessment, but it's more of a problem-solving as opposed to computation. And the questions on this assessment were developed for PISA, which some of you might be familiar with. It's International Student Assessment. And the 18, 19, and 20, 21s get a literacy and numeracy assessment. The 18, 19-year-olds focus on literacy, and the 20, 21-year-olds focus on numeracy. And those are also from an international study, the adult literacy study. So before in 2000, for cycle 4, our survey sponsor wanted to put more attention on the early years and school readiness. So they wanted to increase the amount of information we got, the cognitive measures that we have for this age group. So we've always had the PPVTR, something we had from the beginning, which is a measure of receptive vocabulary, but they want to have more measurements. So we added a few other ones, and I'll go through the process we went through to get those. The ones we ended up choosing were the Who Am I, which is a measure of development, and the number knowledge, which is measures understanding of numbers. One of the things that we have to look for in an assessment is something that we can have administered by lay interviewers and something that's available in English and French or can easily be adapted into French because those are Canada's official languages. When the PVT-R was put into the survey, there wasn't a French version, but we did have one created. And that was quite a lengthy process, and we didn't really have the budget or the time to do it for the new assessment. So we had to find something that we didn't require that large process to do, so nothing heavily language-based. So as I said, there was really a decision we wanted to focus on early child development and to measure that better with some direct assessments. So there are some changes proposed to the questionnaire as well, but really the focus was on putting more direct assessments for children under six. So they reviewed the framework that they had beginning, selected some direct measures based on literature review and review of what other surveys were doing, and then from that selected 16 measures, which were sent to our expert advisory committee for their comments. And from that, we picked a subset of 11 measures. Those were informally tested. Basically, anyone in around the office who had a child the right age was asked to participate, and just so we get a sense of how it would work trying to do this in the home. And what became clear is that trying to bring a stranger into a home with a very young child and have them, especially ones that you had to manipulate the child in some way, made parents very uncomfortable, and that was with, you know, their colleagues. So we dropped doing very young children. We didn't want to test anything that for children younger than three. So we had five measures that we decided to test further with a field test. So basically our criteria were that they're available in English or French, or easily adaptable into, well, usually they're available in English. It's French is usually the issue. That they're appropriate for administration in the child's home with a survey, a sample size of, you know, 35,000 or even with just the 4 and 5 year olds. We certainly were not going to have them come into any site. We had to go into the home. They had to be easy to administer by lay interviewers, and they also had to be easy to score. We didn't want any complicated scoring. We wanted something that can be done right beside the application or, you know, in a scoring unit at our head office. So what we tested the Who Am I number knowledge I mentioned earlier. We tested a subblock of the WIPCR, the early screening inventory, and Raven's colored perspective matrices. And we did this in a field test in two Canadian cities, one English, one French, in the fall of 99. So I'll go through each of the assessments a little bit and what we found when we tested them. So the Who Am I is measures developmental level and acquired knowledge and skills. It was developed in Australia, and it's often used at entry in kindergarten to see where the children are at. So general development is assessed by copying shapes, circles, triangles, and drawing a picture of the child draws a picture of himself. And the acquired knowledge is assessed through writing numbers, letters, words, and sentences. So it's designed, the assessment is designed, you could actually answer in your mother tongue. And we went back and forth whether we would allow children to do it in whatever language they felt like, or just English and French. And we decided to go English and French only for two reasons. One is because it made our lives a lot easier. We didn't have to score booklets in a multitude of languages. But the main reason was because we were trying to measure readiness for school, and being able to speak English or French is an important part of that. So we stuck with English and French. But even children who don't speak a lot of English could do the copy shapes, but even if they couldn't do the writing portion of it. So when we field tested it, it was fairly easy to administer. The children liked it. It was inexpensive. We did drop the drawing task when we put it into this survey because some of the children, especially little girls, spent a lot of time drawing and coloring, and that just did make the assessment last a very long time. The number knowledge is the other assessment that we did end up adding to the survey, and it's to look at the children's understanding of the system of whole numbers. And that's one of the things that we didn't have a lot of information about, was sort of math. We had more literacy, so we wanted to have that. And that was developed at the University of Toronto, that assessment, and we did work fairly closely with the developer of the assessment. It has different levels based on age. So, like, for example, the pre-dimensional level is... The unidimensional level assesses the children's knowledge of number sequence and their ability to handle simple arithmetic problems. So it sort of goes up, and the one level of knowledge is necessary for the next one to develop. So there was a test that went fairly well in the field. There are some small issues that we were able to fix, and we did change the assessment a little bit with the help of Dr. Case, and we did add it to the survey. One thing that you're planning, so you don't think about, but because this assessment is very easy for the parents to know if the child's right or not, they did make more comments than some of the other ones where you can't always tell. So you have to discipline the parents a little bit to not try to keep them not asking, making too many comments. So the ones that we didn't choose, we did test the block design, which is a subset of the Wechsler. Wechsler can be used as an intelligence test. The block design asks the child to make little designs with red and white blocks, and the interviewer will put together a model of these blocks, and the child is supposed to duplicate it. And then if they do that, fine, then they show blocks the design in a booklet, and they do that. The task proved way too difficult for the interviewers to do consistently. Often the models were transposed before they showed them to the child, and the children loved it. They liked playing with the blocks, but it was just, we didn't feel that we actually got very consistent data. We didn't actually even score it because of what we saw, that it wasn't, and the interviewers didn't feel comfortable doing it either. It's also fairly expensive. The early screen inventory is used in often in school entry as well, and to assess children who might need special education. So it's an overview of child development in three areas: visual, motor, language, and cognition and gross motor. We didn't use the language portion. We just felt that it would be very difficult to give consistent responses from the interviewer, so we decided not to put that part, and because we had the PVVT that already covered language. The visual motor has, it's similar to the WIPS, seeing the fact that they build models with blocks so that it's not as complex, and they also had some copying tasks, like in the Who Am I. At the gross motor section, the child has to jump, walk on a straight line, stand on one foot, hop and skip. And all those tasks have to be demonstrated by the interviewer before they do it. And that is one of the difficulties we had. Some of our interviewers are a little bit older, and they had some trouble with the hopping and skipping. But we thought we could surmount that. But because it there was some similarities to some of the other assessments that worked better, we decided not to use this one. Things you don't find out to actually go and try them. And the last assessment was the Raven's color progressive matrices. So this one is supposed to part of intelligence, a measure of executive ability. So the child is shown a design, abstract design, and with four options for a missing piece, and they have to report which is the missing piece is the right one. What's nice about this is very little language. So as long as the child understands English or French, they can answer it. They don't have a lot of language component. It worked fairly well. The children really liked it. It's a very colorful, bright colored, but we just found that it wasn't as, didn't give us as much information as the other two that we ended up choosing, so we did not add it to the NLSCY. So at the end, we added the Who Am I and the number knowledge assessment. We were using those until the end of collection. And actually, we are still using those in our cross-sectional survey that we're doing now. We also did collection in the schools, which was an important part of the design at the beginning, to try and get some information from someone besides the parents. What we did change from cycle to cycle, sometimes we had different types of questions. Sometimes we had kindergarten teachers, sometimes not. Sometimes we had principals, sometimes not. We always required signed parental permission. We don't get signed informed consent because we have this mandate as this National Statistical Agency to collect data. We don't get the signed consent. We go to people's houses, and they always have the right to refuse. That's not a mandatory survey, but we don't have a signed consent. But for the school collection, we did get signed consent from the parents to go to the schools. And that creates part of the problems is that when you get very good cooperation from the teachers, when you add up, you have to get cooperation from the parents, from the school boards. In Canada, education is a provincial responsibility, so we have 10 different systems. So you have to convince 10 provinces to participate, and within those provinces are school boards. Sometimes they don't participate, and in some provinces, it's actually the school that makes those kind of decisions. So you have this many layers of participation. So an example is in our fifth cycle, we made some changes the questionnaire and make it easier for teachers to complete, and we were quite happy that we got a fairly good response rate. They're just mail out, mail back, and we got 71% of the ones mailed out came back, which we're pleased with, but that really was only 42% of the population because of all those permissions. So it's a lot of work and how much data, and there's definitely some bias on who gets the questionnaires completed. Also, in some qualitative testing with teachers, the teachers of older children felt they didn't really know the children well enough to answer some of the questions they didn't have enough contact, they felt, with them. It's also fairly logistically complicated to mail out thousands of questionnaires to schools. Because our sample is clustered, you often have more than one child in a school, so you have to get all the questionnaires in one package with the child's name on it, make sure you don't put the child to the wrong school. And it actually takes quite a while to do. And then also, most schools want to see the signed consent form, so we have to include those in the package as well. So there's a lot of matching of pieces of paper and getting in the right envelope, which sounds should be easy, but it's not. But we do have teacher data, and it does give you a nice context, and there has been some work done looking, comparing what teachers and parents say, although it is fairly consistent. So even though you are at another dimension, it's not telling you a lot of different story. I know some people sometimes think that parents are a little bit, may not always to give you, may give a rosier picture of the children, but we do see a lot of consistency with the teacher data. So we asked teachers about the kind of things that happen in class, what the child's behavior is like in attendance, how involved the parents are, some of their teaching practices, what the teacher perception of the school, like a school climate, and some information about the teachers themselves, like their training and education, their age. When we did do principal questionnaires, we only asked there's only one questionnaire, no matter how many students were in the school. And they were looking more at what the school itself was like. Number of students, what kind of students. Do you have students from, mixed backgrounds, education, the income of the households in your school, how involved the parents are in the school, and what the principal thought about the school, and again, the principal's age, education, and years of experience. So as I said earlier, one of the in the early design we were talking about, it was important to have some community level information, and this was not part right in the LSTY. It was sort of a sister survey that I never worked on, but a little bit of information about it. So one of the initiatives that were to get more information about children under six was called Understanding the Early Years, and the community survey was really trying to give the communities information that they could use to help improve early childhood development in their communities. And so the survey involved working with community groups. The community groups themselves had to develop a consortium of multiple groups to come together to get funding to do the survey in their own communities. And part of the project included a mapping project to look at what resources were available in the communities to help children. So the goal really was to help the community use this information to make improvements. So that's a chart of the survey itself, and it was very similar to the NLSCY. So the household part, the parent part, and the child part were almost identical, and it really was hoping to use NLSCY data as a benchmark for the community survey. They did the same assessments that we did. The one difference is that they used the EDI, the Early Development Index, Early Development Index. Instead of the teacher questionnaire that we used. But it is a kindergarten teacher questionnaire, and the people who developed that questionnaire use the NLSCY questionnaire as their starting point, so there's a lot of similarity. And the nice thing with the EDI is that it's many Canadian provinces use this throughout their school population, so there's a lot of baseline information that you can use to compare. What I don't have slides on, and I don't know why I don't have slides, is that there is an Aboriginal children's survey, but it is not longitudinal. So that was one component of the early planning that it took a while because they only went out in 2006. It does not use NLSCY questions because it worked with Aboriginal people helped design the survey, and they wanted quite different questions. So even though there is information about Aboriginal children, it's not comparable to the NLSCY. They are in planning for their next round. There's funding questions, and as we're in the middle of an election, we won't know the answer to that question for a while. The goal is, if we do it again, will there be more comparable between the cross-sectional general population survey and the original? So we may have some more comparability between those populations. I want to talk very briefly about some of the findings in LSTY. DECAN does not do most of the analysis on the NLSCY, it's mainly done in the academic community. We have done some, and our survey sponsor has done some, but it's mainly academic, and so I don't necessarily know everything that's been done. But I just want to sort of some of the quick things that we have that have been done on the survey. The first release from NLSCY was a volume called Growing Up in Canada. It had many articles just using the first cycle. So, of course, it was only cross-sectional. It was just to give people a bit of a taste of some of the data that would be coming out of the survey. So they looked at the link between hyperactivity and math skills, about aggressive behavior, how that measured over time between the age groups that were covered, and the effect of parenting practices on families with disadvantage. These are some of the examples of the articles that were in that. The next big release was a book called Vulnerable Children, which was edited by Doug Wilms from University of Fredericton. He's done a lot of work with NLSCY data, and out of the data he developed a vulnerability index to try and using a group of the questions, mostly the behavior questions, just get a sense of how many children are vulnerable and what that means. And one of the things that came out strongly in his analysis and that's been used quite a bit is the fact that vulnerability is only weakly linked to income. There are more, as you would expect, as income goes down, the more vulnerable children are, but there's still a fair number of children, even in the highest income quartiles, who have vulnerabilities, and which is important from a program point of view because many programs do target the most vulnerable children, the poorest children, and if you don't look at the children who aren't in the lowest income groups, there are a lot of children you're going to be missing. We did a paper that looked on really trying to use some of the longitudinal aspect to look at some of the questions we ask about parenting and child behavior and linking them together. And not surprisingly, children who have homes where there's punitive parenting styles used who tend to have more aggressive behavior. But what I found interesting about this particular study is that when you look at children whose style of parenting changed for them, where they had punitive parenting at one point in their lives when they were younger, and then the style changed to be less punitive, they're actually the child's behavior changed as well with it. So you could make some changes to child outcomes with some parenting changes as well. Some of the examples that use longitudinal data, we looked at the link between youth depression and their relationship with their parents and their peers. We did a big paper to describe child care in Canada, which has been a perennial discussion in the political circles. Or one of the recent changes in the government completely changed child care policy, so it's, the description of child care has been very well used. Because in Canada, lots of things are done at provincial level, so we do have a bit of a natural experiment we can do. And the province of Quebec has a very different child care policy than most of the rest of the country, so NLSCY data has been used to compare child outcomes in Quebec versus other provinces. And we did a big description of some of the ready to learn assessments that we did, I talked about earlier. We looked at the study that looked at 9-year-olds at school, looked at the results of their early readiness to learn, like the assessments we did when they're 4 and 5, and how they're doing in school when they're 9. And the last big piece of work that was done by the survey sponsor was a conference called Successful Transitions, which really tried to look at the data over, didn't use the last cycle, used the 7th cycle, to look at data over the whole 7 cycles. Unfortunately, that work was not published, because of that, I do have the slides, so if someone's really interested in the details, I can talk more about that later or just send things to people. So some of the things we learned for doing this over the time. Some of the challenges, which I think Paul talked about earlier, and the compromises you have to make. So one of the objectives of NLSCY was to collect information about a wide variety of topics, which means we cover everything, but nothing in any depth. So if someone's very interested in one particular topic, we often don't have the information they want on that. And, of course, that also means a very long questionnaire. The large number of age groups has an advantage in one sense because we were able to produce data right away at the beginning, which I think was important for buy-in. Two people could produce. We could have something to show right at the beginning. But it does mean that we do have a very large questionnaire to manage. And if you remember that diagram with the arrows, that says that we have... when someone actually drew that on paper, I thought, oh, good, something I can actually explain this to people in, less than 30 minutes. That means we have to manage a questionnaire that covers both newborns and 25-year-olds. It's a lot of questionnaire to manage. We're trying to do both longitudinal and cross-sectional, which does make sometimes one takes over from the other. Our sampling and weighting is more complicated. We have several weights on the file, so sometimes people don't know what they should be using, and what I didn't point out maybe in detail is that the ECD cohorts also are mini longitudinal cohorts, so they have cross-sectional and longitudinal weights, and so there's many ways you can cut and slice and dice the sample. Because we are not a scientific-based survey like most of the ones here, we're very much run by a policy shop and an operational shop in StatCan, decisions tend to be made cycle by cycle. They get changed with changes in government can change the direction we're going. So, you know, recently, we've had many elections lately because we've had hung parliaments, but one recent election we went from, there was a plan to have this huge nationwide child care program covering everybody to child care program sending checks of $100 a month to families. So all of a sudden that changes what we are going to be asking about and what the focus of the survey is when that happens from one day to the next. The focus on early child development sort of changed the focus of the survey, and our survey response has been focused on that as opposed to the original longitudinal cohort. Adding back the 6 to 9-year-olds was a very last-minute decision. So those things over time mean that sometimes decisions aren't made necessarily thought out properly. So as much as can be decided at the beginning and followed through, the better. Some examples of the changes. Age, you think, would be a fairly straightforward thing to measure over time, but actually this has caused us a lot of problems. We've changed from using age of time of collection to a reference age, mainly because we don't go out exactly the same 2 years in a row. Sometimes it's just because our collection period is 9 months, you could be collected the early part of the collection in 1 year, the later part, so they're not 2 years apart, and that has complications for how our questionnaires manage, because then you don't have the nice every 2 years data. So we made the change to use a reference age so that everybody is the age we think you are, no matter when, if it's before or after your birthday. But we didn't do that the first few cycles, so there's some. And of course, sometimes people tell you they're a different age. We made the mistake of asking them more than once how old they are, which was not a good idea because then we didn't get the same answer every time. So there's a few children who have changed age, a few children who changed sex. One that I know was legitimate, they actually did change sex, but most of them it's because we get different answers or, you know, typos. And because we use this reference age, the questions the child gets is based on the reference age, but many of the norms are based on their actual age. Sometimes there's some discrepancies between that. As I mentioned earlier, we use a PMK. We don't always use the biological mother. So it's great. It means we actually get an interview instead of waiting for mom to be home ready to answer the questions. But that means that if you have a change, like if a child is all behaviors change from one cycle to the next, is it because dad answered this time instead of mom, or is it because the child's behavior changed? Makes it harder to know that for sure. And that's just a few examples. There's many other things that have changed over time. We've changed content. Sometimes we've tweaked content a little bit so someone's following the same question over time and they get very frustrated that, oh, you've changed my question. Keep it simple wherever possible. We've made things very complicated by having many cohorts, sometimes there's reasons, and I think they had good reasons to do that, but it was made it complicated, so maybe some other things need to be simpler because of that. So whenever things can be kept simpler, it should be, because it's always going to get more complicated over time. Have the resource at the beginning, right at the start. One example that I pulled this from some other presentations, and at the beginning there were 3 methodologists working on the survey, and towards the end we had 13. Partially because things got more complicated, but also because 3 wasn't enough to do the job that was required. Think longitudinally. It sounds obvious, but some decisions made were really cross-sectional, partially because NLSCI was one of the first surveys that StatCan did longitudinally. There was a sort of a crop of them at the same time, so we didn't have a lot of the expertise. So some of the decisions about weighting, for example, were done sort of cross-sectionally and we had to go back and revisit them, thinking them more longitudinally. So the more you can think about in a longitudinal perspective instead of trying to replicate what's done in cross-sectional surveys, the better. And in the UK, you're lucky you have a lot of experience with this, so you have a lot of knowledge that can be drawn upon. Documentation is very important, particularly in the environment that we work in where there is a lot of change and turnover. We don't have a principal investigator. We have public servants who do tend to move around. I'm a bit of an anomaly being there for as long as I have been, and there's nobody from the first cycle who's still working on the project. And so the better things are documented, the better. And also not just what was done, but the thought process behind it, because often you don't know what they were thinking. It probably was a good idea at the time, but we don't know because we don't have the reasons they did things. Really part of what was not planned very well in the survey is the research and analysis portion of not just for the data itself, but methodological techniques. Spend a lot of time just keeping the wheels turning and not enough time stopping to think about what we're doing, checking assumptions along the way, and to make sure there's clear long-term objectives. With our covering all kinds of data, cross-sectional, longitudinal, some things we don't always know where the focus should be are very, not very focused research question, makes it hard to decide. We've had many times we say our survey's too long, we need to cut it, and we never can because you can't choose what's important because our priorities are very... So the better your... How clear your objective, the easier to make decisions, obviously. And that's it.
This recording is copyright of ARIS 2011. It may be reused in the terms of Creative Commons licenses, attribution, non-commercial, share-alike 2.5, UK Scotland license. Go to www.iris.org.uk for more information.